This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Daniel Benjamin, was helping to mobilize the fight against terrorism before most Americans realized the magnitude of the terrorist threat. Benjamin was the National Security Council's Director of Counterterrorism from 1998 to 99 under President Clinton. From 1994 to 97, he was President Clinton's Special Assistant and Foreign Policy Speechwriter. Before entering the administration, he was the Wall Street Journal's Berlin bureau chief and a foreign correspondent for Time. Benjamin is the co-author of the new book, The Age of Sacred Terror. It's both a history of Islamist terror and a behind-the-scenes account of counter-terrorist actions during the Clinton administration. I asked Benjamin if he was convinced by President Bush's speech last week, making the case that we need to go to war if Saddam Hussein doesn't quickly disarm.
I'm not sure the president's presentation made any difference to my thinking, although I think it was the most effective speech he's given yet on the issue. I'm in the same place that I was before, which is to say that I think that we are likely to have to go to war with Saddam Hussein at some point in the future. I'm not fully confident yet that the administration has understood the distinction between jihadist terrorists like Osama bin Laden and his followers and a state sponsor of terror like Saddam Hussein.
What are some of the important distinctions you think need to be made?
Well, Saddam Hussein is not an entirely rational person and certainly not a predictable one, but certain facts are going to govern his calculations. And chief among them is that he wants to hold on to his country. And he knows that doing some things will make that absolutely impossible, one of them being giving a weapon of mass destruction to a terrorist group. By contrast, we know that that Osama bin Laden or Al-Qaeda, what's left of it, or its successor group, and I'm sure there will be one, would not hesitate to use such a weapon against the United States and would probably use it almost as fast as it could get it and design a conspiracy. Well, and I think that these are two very different phenomena.
Daniel Benjamin, you were the director of counterterrorism for the National Security Council under the Clinton administration from 1998 to 99. What was the wake-up call for the Clinton administration about terrorism?
Well, I think the wake-up call or the watershed for us was the bombing of the embassies in East Africa. There had been an awful lot of concern for a number of years about the rising threat of Islamist terror, but the bombings in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam had a catalytic effect because they showed that these terrorists were prepared to kill in a way that previous terrorists had not. Now, the actual number of dead in the two bombings was roughly the same with such attacks as the bombing of the Beirut barracks, the bombing of Pan Am 103. But what was particularly noteworthy was that the terrorists were prepared to kill an awful lot of Africans, including many, many African Muslims, to kill a few Americans. And that was unusual. And also that they were prepared to have so many potential sympathizers injured, grievously wounded. There were something like 5,000 people wounded in the two bombings. And this was a real departure from what we had seen before, because traditionally terrorists have sought to create a sense of theater, a theater of fear, and they wanted to have a few casualties and an awful lot of attention. And here it was clear that the violence itself was the goal. And that was really for us the wake-up call. I should add that it was a case of the alarm going off twice. Just weeks before, we had received intelligence that Al-Qaeda was seeking to procure chemical weapons in Sudan. And so once the bombings were carried out in East Africa and we had a sense of what kind of violence they were prepared to carry out, and we had this information about the chemical weapons as well, we realized that this was not a group that we could count on to calibrate its violence as terrorist organizations had in the past.
Not long after the embassy bombings in Africa, the United States bombed a plant in Khartoum, in Sudan, that it said was making chemical weapons. What was the thinking behind that attack?
As I mentioned, we had this information that bin Laden was working with the National Islamic Front government of Sudan to procure chemical weapons. And the feeling was that anyone who was prepared to do what al-Qaeda had done in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam would not hesitate to go one step further and, in fact, break an almost unbroken taboo. Aum Shinrikyi had used a chemical weapon in Tokyo a few years earlier, but by and large, that we believe that that taboo still held. But now it was clear that there was someone who was prepared to kill on the grand scale and was prepared to use taboo weapons to do so. And as a result, it seemed like not only the wise, but the minimal responsible thing to do to attack the plant in Khartoum. Now, I should just qualify what you said by noting that the intelligence did not demonstrate that chemical weapons were being made there, but rather that the place was in some way associated with chemical weapons. The precursor to the nerve gas, VX, was found right by the by this chemical plant. And in retrospect, that leaves us uncertain as to whether or not it was being made there or transshipped there or stored there before it was actually weaponized. But the fact that we had fairly conclusive indications that there was chemical weapons activity and that al-Qaeda was involved, we know that bin Laden had invested in this effort, made it seem like, made it clear that it was really the right thing to do.
When the Clinton administration ordered the bombing in Sudan, thinking that there was some involvement there with chemical weapons, President Clinton was accused by his critics of wagging the dog because the bombing was 3 days after his testimony before the grand jury about Monica Lewinsky. And his critics were saying, well, sure, he's bombing. It's just a way of distracting from this horrible sex scandal that he's involved with. You were working for the National Security Council in counterterrorism at the time. What was your reaction when you were hearing all these wag-the-dog accusations?
Everyone was clear before the missiles were launched, before the cruise missiles were launched, that there would be some of this, that there would be some argument of wag the dog. And in fact, Secretary of Defense Cohen brought it up in the Principals Committee meeting where they decided to approve the attack. And the president himself knew that he would encounter some criticism. Nonetheless, you know, this is a group of people, and the president in particular, who were charged with national security, and they felt that this was their responsibility. They had to take the flak, really, for the good of the country. I think we were all stunned by how far it went. The lack of belief that the administration might be telling the truth, that the intelligence community might have actually gotten it right, that the soil sample that was collected at the Al-Shifa plant might actually show this, the presence of this precursor, was really remarkable to me and many of my colleagues. And I guess we all felt it was just a low point for trust in government, for people thinking about, you know, the threats we face. There's no question that that impeachment had become the vortex in American life, and everything else was swept into it.
During this impeachment era, when you were working on counterterrorism and some of the counterterrorism aspects were accused of being wag the dog, who were you more frustrated with, the president for having gotten himself into the predicament that made these accusations even possible, or the people who were going after him? Were you more frustrated with them for not kind of being able to distinguish his personal problems from the real problems of international terrorism?
I think everyone who was working in the White House at that time was deeply disappointed by the president's behavior and by the situation that we were in, where we were working extremely hard to carry out what we thought were good policies, and we were undermined by the distraction. At the same time, you know, I was working for that president. I didn't resign because I continued to think that the policies were right, and I continued to think that his enemies were more wrong than he was, and that in fact they. I felt the president could be faulted for giving his enemies an opening, but I think that they deserve a lot of criticism for taking the country away from serious issues and for not having any sense of balance, not having any sense of the proper proportion of these for these different issues.
My guest is Daniel Benjamin, co-author of the new book, The Age of Sacred Terror. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Daniel Benjamin, author of the new book, The Age of Sacred Terror. We're talking about anti-terrorism efforts during the Clinton administration. Benjamin was the National Security Council's director of counterterrorism from 1998 to 1999 during the Clinton administration. You cite several instances where pettiness or infighting or a misguided approach to saving money stood in the way of really dealing a blow to terrorists. Give us one of the examples that you feel is particularly compelling.
Well, this was a period in which I think a group of us in the White House and a group of people in CIA and a sprinkling of people in other agencies recognized that there was a new kind of threat. But we were faced by two problems. One was that when you have a major change in the nature of your security environment, when you have a major change in the nature of the threat, people are invested in not seeing what's new. The bureaucracy doesn't like to change. That's just the nature of large organizations. And what's more is the permanent government is not so eager to get pushed around by the elected government, the government that changes every 4 years. And so we saw, you know, any number of cases where the message really hadn't gotten out. We saw at the State Department, for example, after the embassy bombings, we in the White House literally ordered them to dispatch medicines and vaccines and biochem suits, you know, the very bulky suits that you would wear in a unconventional attack, and other equipment for washing down people who had been people and equipment that had been contaminated, and they just refused to do it. We tried this again and again, and they kept changing the office director, the interlocutor in the State Department who's supposed to deal with it. And finally, after a year of banging our heads on this, we just gave up. You know, we couldn't move the department. The department was also reluctant to take a lot of the money that was being offered to it by the White House, by OMB, to build new and safer embassies. And when OMB, which exists to deny funding to agencies, put hundreds of millions of dollars in the State Department's budget proposal, it got looted for programmatic purposes, so that, you know, we could have any number of different kinds of activities going on at different embassies. And it took a big showdown at the White House to get that money restored to the budget.
After being so involved with counterterrorism, what's it like for you to now watch from the sidelines as we seem to be approaching war with Iraq and as we're kind of worried about what the next terrorist attack is going to be?
My biggest concern is that this paradigm shift, as we call it, this change of in the nature of terrorism really hasn't been absorbed by the country and quite possibly also some of its leaders, because this is really an enduring phenomenon and just profoundly dangerous. When people feel that their killing is divinely sanctioned, it's divinely justified, and that they don't much care about the immediate reaction, whether they themselves are going to die in a suicide attack, then you're dealing with an undeterrable threat. And I don't think people have fully recognized how deeply rooted that is in a region and how much that phenomenon is strengthening in a part of the world that really stretches from Algeria to Indonesia. And I feel that our foreign policy priorities haven't taken that into account yet. I think if we had, we'd be working very hard to try and change the conditions in those countries that breed this ideology, and also to recognize that what goes on in those countries is as dangerous as what goes on between them.
Now, in your book, you write that you have evidence that Hamas, an Islamic fundamentalist group that has attacked Israel, is working now with al-Qaeda. What evidence is there that you could discuss?
Well, there have been several cases of individuals, and we know this because they've been arrested, having contact with both organizations and carrying on, you know, conspiratorial activities. One of them was Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, who was really dispatched by al-Qaeda to go and establish contacts with Hamas, and he was doing surveillance work in Israel sometime before he was caught on that plane trying to ignite the bomb in his shoe. There was another one named, I believe, Okal, who was picked up, I think, in Turkey. This is an extremely worrisome situation because Hamas shares a lot of the ideas of al-Qaeda. If you look at their charter and if you look at their long-term ideology of being part of a new caliphate that embraces all of the Islamic community. But their behavior has been more calibrated. It's been more old-style terrorism. And if Hamas were indeed to turn into an al-Qaeda-like group, then the situation in the Middle East could become much worse.
Well, you also say that Hamas may target the United States in the future. What motivation would they have for doing that?
Jihadist terrorists believe that the United States and Israel are the far enemy, that there is a war being waged against all of Islam, that sometimes they differ as to who's pulling the strings, but usually these days the United States gets the lion's share of the guilt. And the great innovation of bin Laden and al-Qaeda was that they decided that instead of going after the near enemy, instead of attacking the secular rulers in the Islamic world and trying to bring about a revolution at the national level, they went to the international level. And the idea was that if you could convince the United States to withdraw its support for these regimes, then they would have no way of defending themselves. That's really one of the key things about al-Qaeda. And al-Qaeda believes that to do that, to change America's mind, to force it to withdraw, requires an enormous amount of violence. So it's entirely possible that if Hamas becomes frustrated with its fight at the national level, it too could leap to the international level and fight in the same way as al-Qaeda and attack Americans.
What do you think the odds of that happening are?
It's very difficult to say. So much depends on what else happens in the territories and with Israel. If, in fact, a new generation of leaders does come to the fore very soon in the Palestinian Authority, then it's entirely possible that they would see the need to go after Hamas in a really vigorous way. The Palestinian Authority has always had the ability to shut down Hamas in the past. That ability may be somewhat eroded now, but a lot will really depend on what the PA looks like in the months ahead.
My guest is Daniel Benjamin, author of the new book, The Age of Sacred Terror. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Daniel Benjamin, author of the new book, The Age of Sacred Terror. He was the National Security Council's Director of Counterterrorism from 1998 to 1999 during the Clinton administration. Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, there's something essentially goofy looking about him, and he didn't do a very effective job, thank God, of setting his bomb off, the bomb in his shoe. And, you know, you write in your book that the foiled plot to bomb New York landmarks, that some of the people behind that seem pretty inept. And the impression I get is that you think the FBI found it a little easier than they should have to dismiss terrorist threats because they thought of a lot of these guys as being goofy and inept.
That was certainly true in the early 90s. I think the two key facts that persuaded the FBI that it didn't have too much to worry about were the fact that the man who rented the van, the Ryder van that was used to blow up the bomb underneath the World Trade Center the first time around, went back to the rental agency and tried to get his deposit back, tried, in fact, three or four times. So this convinced the Bureau, I think, that they were dealing with some morons. The next case, the Day of Terror, in which the commuter tunnels and 26 Federal Plaza, which is the FBI headquarters and the UN, were to be targeted, was a conspiracy that only progressed because there was an FBI informant in the group who was telling them how to build bombs and do basic terrorist activities. So there again, I think they felt like they'd wrapped up a bunch of incompetence. Richard Reed doesn't inspire a lot of awe as a terrorist operative. That's certainly true. But I think that it's a mistake to think of him in the same category, because what's interesting about Richard Reed is that he converted to Islam and became a believer in this very, very radical version of Islam. And he represents, in that sense, a vanguard. I think that we're going to have an increasingly difficult time of finding out exactly who the terrorists are, because they will come from the ranks of non-Middle Eastern Europeans or Americans. And that is a phenomenon that should deeply concern us, and we will have a hard time defending against.
You are skeptical that there are any real ties between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. Do you think, as we threaten to go to war with Iraq, and as we put the pressure on Saddam Hussein, and as he sees his life as a tyrant drawing to a close, that he may feel desperate enough to take a chance and partner with al-Qaeda, even though he knows they might turn against him, but what's he got to lose?
There's a paradox. Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda aren't natural allies. But in a situation in which his regime is threatened, then all bets are off, and then he might be prepared to do something that otherwise he never would have imagined.
Now that we've made the threat to go to war, even though you're skeptical that we need to do it now, do you think we have to do it? Because we've kind of like stirred up the wasp's nest. So unless we follow through, are we more vulnerable than we were because Saddam Hussein would feel so threatened and desperate?
I don't think we're there quite yet, and I think there's still room to build the international support that will make it an effort that will be viewed as more legitimate by the international community. I don't think that it's we're in a position yet where our credibility is at stake. I think that, as I said, I don't think we're going to get out of this one easily. I think we probably are going to have to confront him militarily sooner rather than later, but I just hope that we get the timeline right and that those who are prepared to wreak real havoc, real catastrophic destruction, are not in a position to do so when we go to war.
Daniel Benjamin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Daniel Benjamin is co-author of the new book, The Age of Sacred Terror. He's the former director of counterterrorism for the National Security Council.